Hi everybody, nice to see you again, nice to hear you in the new episode, podcast episode on this week with a special guest, really a great person. Normally we just talk about leadership, management, safety and security and all the stuff that you know, but today we have a talk with Dr. David Rubens. David, nice to see you here, nice to have you in this podcast episode. How are you doing?
Anton, always a pleasure, always has been a pleasure for many years to share space with you, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation today.
It's absolutely a wonderful thing. Just I was thinking about that when I met you the first time, I guess it's 2014, something like that, in Gothenburg, Sweden. And for everybody, Sweden, not Switzerland. That's an important thing. But this was a really good time. And this was an ACES International Convention, from the European Convention, something like that. And we just keep in mind talking and don't get too much space between. But social media allows that to be connected a long time. And now it's time to talk with you and your journey and your personality and your professional environment, a little bit privately as well, I guess this would be nice. And before I introduce yourself, let me just ask you and let do it you on yourself, David, if anybody or nobody knows you and you're just over there in a barbecue or in an environment like a pub, something like that, and some ask you, who's David? What's he doing? Where did he come from? What do you tell them? What would you say?
It's an interesting question. Well, the first thing I'd say is one more beer, please. I'll have another beer. I always feel the conversation goes better over a beer. We really should be having some beers on the table, Anton, to do this properly, let me tell you. But I'm a security professional. I'm a security professional. It's like you ask a general in the army, what do you do? He says, I'm a soldier. You know, I'm a soldier. First things, forget the gold and the glitter and the caps. I'm a soldier. And I'm a security professional. That's what I do. And there is a great phrase that South Africans use, They say, I'm a protector. And I think for somebody to say I'm a protector is a good thing. And I believe I am a protector. I've been doing it for 40 years. I've been a protector for 40 years. It's something I enjoy very much. It's something I take great pride in. But I also believe that if you call yourself a protector, that comes with a package. And the package is that you have to accept the responsibility. You need to get it right, because getting it wrong has consequences. And I'm sure we'll discuss that. But if you look at all aspects of security and risk management, from close protection to asset protection, through to risk management, to government COVID policies, getting it wrong has consequences. So I am first and foremost a security professional, just like a general is a soldier. Besides that, I've been very lucky. As you know, I've been very lucky. I think I've had three sort of areas of my life. One is as a practitioner, I've done my share of 12-hour shifts. I've done my patrols in the rain. I've sat at the back of the back gate where nobody's interested. I've been waiting for my shift relief to come, and they haven't come. And I realize how important, being late by 10 minutes really upsets a lot of people. So I'm a practitioner, first and foremost, I'm a practitioner. I've been very lucky because I've done academic work. And as you know, we will discuss it, but I did my master's, I've done my doctorate. And so I have a deep love of the academic work and a belief in the value that brings to the game. And I'm very, very lucky in that I'm a consultant, and I go all over the world and I work with people and organizations trying to work out how we can take this wonderful stuff that we know and make it more applicable and more useful to organizations in order to allow them to do their stuff better. So I'd say that's the three areas. I'm a practitioner, I'm an academic, and I'm a consultant.
Wow, just like something like that would be great.
No, before you do that, Anton, I think you should speak to my wife, because if you speak to my wife or my kids, you get a completely different story, let me tell you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
As you know, As you know, can I tell a quick story on that? In 2019, as I'm sure you know, I was voted the number one global influencer for thought leadership by the number one in the world, which I'm very proud of. So I told my family, you know, I've been voted number one thought leader and influencer, which I thought they'd be very proud of. I don't think it made any difference. But I heard my daughter at the time was about, I think she was 17 years old. And I heard her a couple of days later on the phone to a friend of hers. And she said, yeah, my dad got an award. She said, clearly they said, what did they get the award for? And she said, well, I don't know, but I think he's a world expert in influenza. I said, no, I'm not a world expert in influenza. I'm a global influencer. It's not the same thing. Don't you know what I do? And as you know, nobody is a legend in their own house. Nobody is a hero in their own house. So in my house, I have four kids and a rabbit, and I am officially below the rabbit. You know, when I come home and my wife says, okay, kids, somebody make dad a cup of tea. They say, we can't, we're feeding the rabbit, we're busy. So in my house, officially, I'm below the rabbit. So there you go.
Okay. It's just like Alice in Wonderland.
Absolutely. Good one.
But yeah. That's the thing, but it's absolutely awesome how you told that, because soldier, security professional, protector, all what you told us, it's the bubble that's count, and it's everybody's bubble. So if you are inside the bubble and you just reach something or gain some really good stuff, topics, a lot of salary and a professional environment, but what are you outside of your bubble? That would be really interesting for everybody to think about that. And maybe you just, if you have some pets at home, this would be great to see if you are a little bit more below or under the rabbit or whatever do we have at home. Yeah. But it's great, exactly. Great. But David, you told us 40 years. I mean, it's a huge number, 40 years in a safety, security, risk, business continuity, crisis management, whatever you name it. And but how do you start it in there? Which is like, you're just over there. Okay, I'm here. I'm a little less or under God, but I am on the dark, maybe in an environment. But how do you get there? You are really a professional, you name it, and you are an influencer, how you told us before. But how do you get started? What's going on? How do you just like, it was easy to just start in a security professional environment, or go just military style, law enforcement, or where was the starting point? Maybe some turnarounds or some big decisions that you had made.
Like so many things, it's a mixture of the right place at the right time, being lucky, having an opportunity, finding something you like. But also, I think where I was very, very lucky was right from the beginning of my career, I was with good people. I was with good professional people. I was actually with some of the best people in the world. My first job was, I was in the military. I did a short military, so I just got 2.5 years in the military. So I'd done that. So I had that background. You know, I was in the military. I felt quite confident physically. I was in a combat unit. So I felt quite confident in myself. You know, I was young. I was 21. I came out of the military at 21. So, you know, I was young. But I'm Jewish, and I was in Germany, and I got picked up by some Israeli teams, and I was asked to become the security team leader for the Israeli embassy or the Israeli consulate in Munich. This was in 1981, so 40 years ago. They were 41 years ago. And at the time, there was two areas of attacks on the Israeli Jewish community. There was the PLO.
Okay.
And the Palestinians who were doing stuff all over the world. They just shot the Israeli ambassador in London, Arlov. And there was the neo-Nazis. And the neo-Nazis in Germany were quite bad. They just firebombed the Jewish old people in Munich. And so there was a movement to try and bring a slightly more professional aspect to the security management. And I was in Munich with my girlfriend. I had no connections with anything, but I was sort of went down there, you know, on Friday evening and spoke to some people. And they got in touch with me and said, listen, we're trying to put together a team. Would you like to come on the team? Or would be with your background, would you be team leader? So I said, fine. And so they trained me. And they trained me with the LL teams, the Israeli LL teams. And I still use that today. You know, when I do my stuff and when I teach my stuff and when I run my programs, what they taught me then, I still use. And so I was very, very lucky that right from the beginning, from day one, I was brought up in an atmosphere that says there is a correct way of doing this. There is a structured, professional, effective way of doing this. And your first duty is do it like this. You know, if this is what we say you need to do, do this. And that means if you're going to patrol in a certain way, patrol. If you're going to do a risk assessment in a certain way, risk assessment. So, for example, on the very, very first morning, I came into the Jewish community in Munich, in the Viktualienmarkt. I remember it very well. And there was a security booth inside the building. And I said, what eyes do we have on outside the building? So we don't have any eyes on. I said, right, first thing, right now, by 10 past nine, I want somebody outside. I want somebody looking up and down the street. Because then people can see us and they notice us, but we have an idea what's going on. Otherwise, we don't know what's going on. So that's the very, very first thing. And you won't believe it, within 3 days, we spotted something. And we spotted a spotter car. And a car went past twice. On the third time, we looked at it and we said, what's that? Because we recognized the car. We went by three times in 20 minutes. And they looked at us and we go, got you. You just know, you know. You know when they look at you and you go, I've got you. Now, we have no idea why, and of course they disappear, they don't come back. But I am absolutely convinced that if we hadn't done that, then we would have been considered as a potential target. So there is something called target selection process, which is based on rational choice theory. There's a reason why people choose a potential target. And ease of access is one thing. And ownership of territory is another thing. If you can go into a place where nobody owns that territory, you feel free. But if somebody comes in, what we now call the power of hello, hi, can I help you? That's already claiming territory. And the fact that we had somebody outside that building paying attention, and the third time that car went past, they went, that's interesting. And they spotted that was good security. And this was until today, you know, these are the principles that I'm using. So I think one of the things that gave me real, real advantage was right from day one, I had an understanding that there is a correct way of doing this. And most people didn't have that then. And most people actually don't have that now. I've got to say that.
So the first and the most important thing, do it under the correct way, just told you, or just to decide and to do it and keep focused on them. But after because that embassy, after this embassy time and after the service there, and what's the next step to get in this huge world?
I went off track for 10 years. I then went to India. I spent 2.5 years in India, and I was doing two things. I was in Buddhist monasteries and I was smoking dope on the beach, and I sort of went from very, very intense, basically monastic life to basically very, very enjoyable, happy life on the beach. And I have those two parts of my life. I have the sort of the very disciplined part. And then I'm very happy to relax for a few years and just take it easy. So I spent 2.5 years in India. Then I went to Japan and spent 5.5 years in Japan. And I did martial arts. I did Aikido, Yoshinkan Aikido, which is the hard, it's considered the hard style. Actually, all styles of Aikido are hard, but I was very lucky. I trained with the Tokyo Riot Police Martial Arts Squad. And there's a very famous book called Angry White Pajamas about that program. And I was there from 1984 to 1988-89, which is not right now considered the golden age of Yoshinkan Aikido in Tokyo. And there was a group of us who are still around now. 40 years later, we're still around, still talk to each other, still sort of are that network. But I trained, basically, that's what I did for four and a half years. I trained nonstop, 6 hours a day for 4 years. That's what I did, for 2.5 years. I was an uchideshi. I was a live-in student, one of only four, and then I was a staff instructor. So one of only four Westerners who were ever uchideshi, live-in students, staff instructors.
Wow.
I know, so, and so, you know, and So there are people who still know me, you know, who know me as David Aikido. That's how I am. I was training yesterday. Still training. Had a good class yesterday. And then I went to Australia, and then I spent a few months in Australia. Then I went back to India. Then I went back to Japan, America. Eventually, I was in America teaching Aikido, and in 1991, my dad died, basically. He had cancer. And I got a phone call. I was in America, and I got a phone call on a Friday saying, listen, dad's about to die, come up. And by Monday, I was home, and we had 10 days together before he died, which was excellent. But then somebody asked me to teach a self-defense course for women. Somebody from the local police asked me to teach a program, one class for self-defense for women. So I said, fine, happy to do so.
And
This was in London. Having not been in London for 15 years, you know, having been away, I left when I was 18, 17, and now I was 31. So I came back, and so this was 1990. I was 32.
Completely different world, I guess. Completely different after 14 years.
In some ways, completely different. In some ways, exactly the same. You know, I mean, there were people literally still standing by the same bus stop at 8 o'clock in the morning. They've been there, you know, since then. Anyway, so I got somebody asked me, would I teach this? Somebody from the police, local police, when you asked me, would I teach self-defense? They liked it. And they said, right, teach it again next week. We're going to bring our boss back. So I said, okay. So I did that. They liked it. They said, right, teach it again next week. We're going to bring our boss back. And I did. And then they said, listen, if you want to set up a dojo, we'll help you. We'll support the dojo. And so I set up a small little dojo in West Hampstead, and we opened on the 16th of June, 1991. So, and we were teaching again yesterday. So that's 31 years I've been running that dojo. Can't believe it. And so that's what happened. So I started a small little Aikido dojo. And then what happened was I heard on the radio that Westminster Council, Westminster, London, the main council in London, was going to start a school for bouncers. So the bouncers, security people working in pubs who are unregulated, they were going to start a school for bouncers. And I heard this on the radio. So I got in touch and I said, what is this about? And they said, blah, 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 blah. And I said, I think I can do that. They said, okay, apply. So what I did was I went to a couple of people who I knew were teaching door supervisors. And they were rubbish. They knew nothing. They knew absolutely nothing. They were just big guys who told war stories. And I thought, if you're doing this and you're considered good, I can do this as well. Because I know nothing about this, but you know nothing about it either. But in 6 months, I'll be a lot better, but you still won't. So basically what happened was I started this little training school for door supervisors. And I learned quickly, and I built a program up. And within a couple of years, we were one of the three top trainers in the UK. I think we had about 12,000 people through the program eventually. Whoa. But that's how I started. That's how I started. And I started on that. And then I got into close protection because I'd done close protection. I'd run operations. I'd worked in a close protection environment. And again, I started teaching these programs and they went quite well. And that's really how it happened, Anton. And that's basically how it all happened. And then in 2004, so I'd already been running my consultancy for about 13 years then and, you know, earning a living, doing okay. And we were lying in bed on a Sunday morning. Am I reading the newspapers? And my wife said, you need to do this. I said, what is it? She said, it's a master's program. And it was a master's program from Leicester University. And she said, it was in the newspaper. She said, you need to do this. So I got in touch with them.
Your wife told you, you have to study, right?
Yeah. Well, she said, this is for you anyway. She said, this is for you. So I got in touch with Leicester. And, you know, I was already a successful consultant. I was running a successful business. And I was in my mid-40s, you know, so I wasn't young. Mm-hmm. And they said, okay, well, write us an essay on what you want to do. And basically what I did was I did my master's there. And that's how I started the next stage of my life, which was a consultancy. Because basically speaking, what the master's is, it took everything I knew and really gave me a powerful structure. And anybody who knows me will know I will always talk about structure and methodology, structure and methodology. And that's where it started from, structure methodology. But I'd already been bringing structure methodology to my door supervisor courses and close protection courses. You know, the difference between what we were doing and everybody else was doing was we had structure and methodology. And really, and here we are, Anton, you know, 40 years later, here we are, my God.
Where was the turnaround or the next level from this operational hands-on field activities to think, oh, there's a next level below, there's something bigger, to get an overview, to get this methodology or this strategic things. And how do you get that the point, well, the next level up?
For me, it was my master's. I mean, I knew when they asked me, why do you want to do this master's? And the master's at Leicester, and it's still, I mean, if people want to do it, it's still there. It's still going on. So if you want to do it, I recommend it. And if anybody's interested, I'm happy to help people. You know, I'm happy to support people. But I knew, they said to me, why do you want to do this master's? And I said, for three reasons. A, I want to know what you've got. If you're this good, you've got stuff that I want to have. B, I want to be invited back to be an instructor, because if I'm on any course, I always have the ambition that if it's any good, I would like to be good enough that you say to me, right, come on and be an instructor. And C, I want to travel around the world in business class and stay in nice hotels and talk about it. I want that. That's going to be my job. But not standing outside.
That's the biggest and the most important one.
Exactly. I don't want to stand around outside for the rain for 12 hours or do patrol, I mean, anybody who knows about close protection work knows, if you do close protection work, that is a tough life. I mean, that is tough, you know, because absolutely, your day starts 2 hours before the principal appears. You've done 2 hours. When the principal goes to bed, you do another 2 hours.
Yeah, you don't have your own life. You don't have your own life. You just live for everybody else, but not for your own. That's really important. And I guess for our audience, or it doesn't matter on podcasts or just listening or on YouTube as well. And when we're let the video online, it's so important for everybody out there. If you are working in the security or safety, business continue, whatever environment, in professional environment, and you are just thinking about that sometime and someday, I will just quit. I have enough from this training or from this field activities, from this outside and on a lower level, on a basic level. But you do it well and do it great and great job. But sometimes there come some influence around you and just to push you in a way, and you think, oh, I'm enough, I have enough, I want just change my life or get the next big step. Education, further education, it's so much important. It's the most important thing, I guess. This is lifelong learning as well. But how you sell it, all these police officers, this the military, the law enforcement guys, and women, men and women, they just started in a basic way and they think, okay, that's my life, I will do that for the rest of my life. But life changes sometimes, and I guess that's so important to hear that. And it's a great example from you to say, okay, I did a master degree and I have to do a lot for that, I have to gain it, and I have to 3 points that I'm looking for. And that's really a golden nugget, I guess, for our audience. And it's a great thing to hear that, David.
I mean, the thing about this sector is, security sector in general, it is one of the very, very, very few sectors in the world where today you can start on absolutely the lowest level. You can be the third person outside the back of the car park, outside the back of in the gate. And if you've got a bit of attitude, in a year's time, you can be team leader. And a year after that, you can be in the office in the control room. And if you want to, a year after that, you can be in the office in a suit and tie doing customer relations. And a year after that, you can be, you know, client management. Because if you've got something about you, then you have value in the sector. I, as I said, I'm still using stuff now that I was using 20, 30 years ago. But I remember that one of the opening things that I used to sell my close protector on my door supervisor course. But so I guess that's now going back 30 years. So going back 30 years.
Absolutely.
And one of the things I used to say on the very first morning was, if you want to do this properly, the first thing is, when you get up in the morning, first, there's three things. A, turn up on time. Just turn up on time. And turning up on time doesn't mean 30 seconds early. It means turning up on time 20 minutes early, 30 minutes early. Hi, boss, you want a cup of coffee? I'm here. Because then they can relax. They know that you're there. If you turn up 20 seconds beforehand, that's not on time because the boss doesn't know. That they say, my God, I'm under stress. So turn up 20 minutes early. Say, boss, do you want a cup of coffee? Because, you know, a lot of people can build a career just by bringing the boss a cup of coffee. Yeah. But you're there. So, and do that always. Second thing is, and it sounds stupid, wear the right clothes. Wear the right shoes. Wear the right tie. Wear the right jacket. Be there properly. Wear the right shirt. Because then two things. A, you fit in and you belong. Mm-hmm. B, you feel comfortable. Because if you're there in the wrong clothes and you know you've got the wrong clothes on, you're self-conscious. You know you don't belong there. And the third thing is, when you brush your teeth in the morning, ask yourself a simple question. What can I do better today? What can I do? What can I do? Can I get something? Can I think of something? Can I do some research? Nowadays, you know, we have Google. We didn't have Google then, but now you've got Google. If you're going to be working somewhere or working for somebody or with somebody, Google them. Find out, what do they do? What do they like? Who they are? And if you have those three things, you turn up on time, you wear the right clothes, and you think about what you're going to do and try to do it a bit better, you will automatically be in the top 20% of this industry, because 80% of people will not do that.
So much content.
I get people even now saying, you know, mate, David, I meet people all over the world. Say, David, you won't believe it, but you told me something in 1997 in London. They say those three things: turn up on time, wear the right clothes. You know, they said, you know what? That started my career.
Absolutely. It's so important that you told us. So important to get to change the perspective, the view, to change that from just I'm a guard, I'm a security guard, safety guard, whatever. I'm just a shift leader, or something like that. Just where's the next step? Where's the own next step? And just where's my North Pole star? Where's my fixed star over there? Just what I want to reach in the next 3 or 5 years. It's so important to think about that. And then do it in the right way, and take your ownership to do it in a good way, in the right way. And I guess this one thing that we just don't talk about that, but let keep us that in mind. Your first stages, military and the ambassador and Aikido, they are all things together. One really important thing. There are more, but just one that I just keep in mind for us audience as discipline. Discipline. And discipline, it's one thing that you need as well in a further education for a bachelor, master's degree, a PhD program, whatever. Discipline. And if you have that, if you have that already earned or just worked for that, and you have it in yourself, in your body, in yourself, then just you have that. The most important thing to get the next step or to get in the next hierarchy level and do it in the right way. You have discipline. You have a lot more than other students in the civilian life doesn't have. So just
that's true. That. But that's true. But that is not to say that you need to have military or police background or martial arts background, because I don't want that. That's not the message I'm trying to give. You're absolutely right. Those values bring things, but you can have those values in your own way, in a different, you know, from a different perspective. I'm the last person to say that a prerequisite for doing this is to have military or police or martial arts background. That's not true. So you're absolutely right, Anton, but I wouldn't want that to be the message that everybody takes from here. You know, you need to be disciplined and you need to be professional and you need to be respectful. And you need to respect the world, but you need to respect what you are doing as well. You need to do it. There's a word in Japanese called sumel, and it means honest, to do it honestly. But you hear it a lot in the dojo. And it says, you know, when you open the door, open the door properly. If you open the door, you don't just open, you open the door sumel, you know, sumel. You open the door properly. If you give somebody a cup of tea, you offer them a cup of tea. When you pick up the phone, you do it honestly. And that is something that if you can live your life like that, then I think it brings value, not just in what we're doing, but people recognize that. And it gives you a foundation to build some stuff on. So as you said, these things are useful, but you don't have to come from that particular background to have them.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. That's awesome to hear. And your story, your lifetime story, it's an absolutely change of perspective. And it's a good things. There are good things for everybody just listen or to see that and to hear that from you. And I guess we just change a little bit the focus on the next part of this this talk. And let's talk about what do you guess? What we miss in a professional environment, in an enterprise company environment, managers level or board of directors, what we should do, what they should focus more in this time, in this VUCA world, maybe we will name it, or dynamic world, or just all these things that happen around us. What do you think? It's the most important thing to look for leadership, safety, security. Words, what would you say? What we have to do? What have executives to do to reach, to focus?
It's interesting, Tony, because VUCA, of course, volatile, unstable, complex, and ambiguous is the world we live in. But VUCA has been used for 20 years now. I would say it goes back to what we've spoken about, because if those are universal truths, then they're universal everywhere. So it's about respecting what we do. It's about recognizing the structure and the methodology. It's believing it, it's taking it seriously. It's having the expertise. It's embedding it in what you do personally and organizationally. I think one of the things that we've seen around the world over the last 10 years is that organizations and governments and agencies and ministries and whatever just have not been paying enough attention or giving enough respect to risk management. And one of the things about risk management is it says there is an alternative reality. There's an alternative reality. This happened. And if we'd done risk management properly, that did not need to happen. So as an example, in the UK, in the United Kingdom, in COVID, we've had 150,000 deaths, 150,000 deaths. That did not have to happen. That did not have to happen. And if we'd paid attention to our own risk management protocols, we couldn't have stopped COVID. But we could have engaged with COVID and managed COVID and understood COVID much, much better. And so one of the things that I speak about, and anybody who understands this, but certainly I speak about it a lot, is you have to differentiate the event from the disaster or the crisis. Hurricane Katrina, 2005. Hurricane Katrina was not a disaster. Hurricane Katrina was an event. The disaster was the failure of the emergency management agencies at the federal, state, and local levels to understand what they would need to do if a hurricane hit, because everybody knew that a hurricane was coming, and they knew the problems it would create. But when it happened, they basically were not ready. They were not ready. And there is a phrase from the academic world, there's a phrase which says, it is a dereliction of duty. It's a dereliction of duty. But that goes back to my very opening comments about being a protector. Now, you can be a protector standing outside a pub or outside a children's home or outside a building site and you're a protector, or you can be a close protection officer and you're a protector. But if you're a national level planner, then you're also a protector. If you're in the auditing body, then you are a protector. And the reason that these things go wrong and that we have the terrible consequences that we see is not because of the external event, but because of internal failures and weaknesses, which are known and understood. And people say, you know what? I don't care. I don't care. I know it's there. I'm not going to do anything about it. And then what happens is that becomes embedded in your organizations.
Let's go in there. Let's go in there. I don't care. It's not in my business. Mind your own business. I don't want to handle that. Why managers or executives think like that? What's the reason? Or security professionals or safety professionals in the company, in the enterprise, have to to get more power and more engagement to reach that point, go over the point, over the wall to a new mindset for all these leaders out there. What they have to do to get a new mindset on, we have to care, we have to do it, we have to handle that, we have to think, to plan, to do, and to implement. How we reach that mindset?
Those are two questions. So there's two questions there, Tony. The first question is, why are managers like that? And the second is, what can we as security and risk management professionals do to influence that conversation? The reason that managers do that is because that is what they are incentivized to do. That is what their incentives are. You look at the financial organizations, bankings. They're being fined billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars. They say, I don't care, because I get my bonus of $1 million because I do this. And the company pays $1 billion to $5 billion down the line, but they are not held responsible. So what happens is the person offloads the risk, takes personal benefit, walks away, leaves the crap behind for everybody else. Well, if that's what's happening, then what the hell do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen? They're going to take that. And that's true with, you know, with Boeing 737 MAX, and it's true with Volkswagen, you know, Volkswagen emission scandals, and it's true with the 2008 financial crash, and it's true with the Grenfell Tower disaster in 2017 in London. And it's true with a whole load of other stuff, that the incentives are built in there to screw the system. That's what they're about. And so therefore you have an overarching regulatory framework to say, you're not allowed to do this, and you're not allowed to do this, and you're not allowed to do this, because if you do that, it is dangerous. Therefore, you're not allowed to do that. But what you then have is you have the regulators and the organization and the government colluding with each other to ignore the rules that they have made. And that's what happens. And you look at all of these examples, and they are colluding, and everybody knows. And the thing is, there is no personal responsibility. They walk away. They just walk away. And if that is the situation, then that's what's going to happen. So that's on that side of things. On the other side of things, how do we as a profession have what I would say is impact and influence? How do we have impact and influence? And the first thing is, we've got to be good enough to be part of that conversation. And I've been having this conversation for 30 years. And we said, you know, if you want, you know, people have been saying, how do we influence the boardroom? Well, if we want to influence the boardroom, we've got to be good enough to be there. So from my perspective, we should be as good as what we do as the tax advisors are at what they do. You know, and if you have a tax advisor, they are absolutely, you know, they are world class, and they can, you know, they've got, they're professional, and they can help the organization do what they need to do. We've got to bring that to the game. And you can say, well, that's very difficult. But if you look at something, let's say, for example, a nuclear power station or a oil and gas rig, somewhere which is very complex, very high level, very highly efficient and regulated. Their health and safety is world-class. Their health and safety is world-class. Their security and risk management is rubbish, but their health and safety is world-class. Now, I've only been on an oil rig a couple of times. I mean, I've been in nuclear slightly more than that. But I know in a nuclear facility, for example, which I know a bit about, if there are two yellow lines and it says you need to walk between those yellow lines and your foot goes outside the yellow line, they say, sorry, sir, could you please walk inside the yellow line? And if you go outside again, they will escort you off the nuclear station. They'll say, sorry, sir, bring your pass. They don't care who you are. Bring your pass. You're outside now. You've broken the health and safety. You are outside. You're not permitted to be here. And if it says, please stick to 10 miles an hour, and you go at 12 miles an hour, the next time you come to a check, they'll say, we saw on the radio, please, sir, could you please go and report? You are now no longer permitted to be on this base. So the health and safety is absolutely shit hot. So there's no reason that we could not get security and risk management to that level. It just needs to be something that is important enough. And if we are to make it important, we have to take that story forward. We've got to carry that message forward. And we've got to demonstrate that we can do that without disrupting the organization. Because a lot of times when people bring this stuff in, you look at it and you go, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, that's too tough or too complex. So we've got to bring it in a way that is acceptable. But my feeling is, you know, you look at health and safety and what they've achieved over the last 20 years in regulated environments, they have absolutely changed the conversation. Absolutely. We should be able to do the same thing as well.
Yeah, so that's a few points in there that just need a second or a third podcast episode to talk about that, because it is so much in there. And you told us that there are two parts, the responsible person as well, maybe the CEO or the CFO, the COO, and the other guys, the specialists, the expert, internal, external, whatever. And I guess there are one point there that maybe we miss or just let it a little by side. That means how, if you are a salesman and you are out there and you do your work, your daily work to get your money, you win your money to get that and get your paycheck for the next month. You have to do it, and you have to do it hardly, very hardly, day for day for day for day. But the point is, that's sales. And sales isn't negative. But most people thinking sales, oh Jesus, this is a salesman, this is too much. I don't like that style, I don't like that. But maybe it would be great for every security professional to think a little bit like marketing strategies, sales strategies, methodologies, like something like that. How I can influence and get an impact on my executive board, the board of directors or my next supervisor, to get that and to put the seam there and let the plant grow in a few days, weeks, month, and then you can earn the fruits. Sales, maybe marketing could be a new add-on in the security environment, I guess. What do you think about
that? I think so. And it's an interesting point. It's something which I consider that I'm quite good at. Because again, I've been trained. So there's. I'm going to take it two aspects. I'm going to take the American aspect and then the Japanese aspect. So I've been trained within both of those environments. So the first thing is, from a Japanese perspective, is you never try and sell anything. Never, ever, ever go into the room thinking, I want to sell you something. Because as soon as you do, that puts a barrier. As soon as you walk in, there's a barrier. And I'm sure you've had that conversation. I've had conversations with people, and we've had a meeting, and it's been really good and relaxed, and I've been really enjoying it. And then suddenly they change. I think, you're going to try and sell me something now. And you can see in their body, and you can see in their eyes, and you can just see, and you're going to try and sell me something. And immediately you go, well, mate, you know. Yeah. Whereas before that, it was very nice. So you never, ever, ever go in thinking, I want to sell you something. What you go in is, you go in with absolute belief that what you've got is good, and it's good, it's nice, and it's useful. And so what I do is I just basically talk about the stuff that I do. And I say, you know, this is what I think, like structure and methodology, and, you know, this is a risk assessment, and this is how you do it. Do you think that's interesting? And they usually go, yeah, that's pretty interesting. That's nice. That's good. That seems to make sense. I said, fine. So the first thing is, what you do is you just explain what you can do. And then hopefully they then come to you. So if you're selling, you're chasing the kitten. No, you don't chase the kitten. You let the kitten come to you. You let the kitten come to you, because you've got something of use. Right, so that's the first thing. Next thing. If the meeting is going well and everything is fine, when you walk into that room, before you've walked into that room, you should, again, think about what you're doing. You should know what it is they want to say yes to, because clearly there's something, you believe there's something that you can do to help. What is it that you've got that they can say yes to? And so if it's going well, what you suggest is, let's do something together. Let's do something. Let's have another meeting. Let's set up a little working group. Let's maybe have what we say is let's have a webinar. But let's do something together. Because once you do that first thing together, then you've got the connection, which is what it's about. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. That's the Japanese side of things. Let's go to the American side of things. The American side of things says there's only three questions. Do you have But do I have something that is of value to the market? Not that I'm trying to create, but that I'm trying to push on the market, but something that I think has value on the market. Yes. Okay. Can I then have a connection with some people who might be interested? So it's a connection. And third thing is, do I have a business model which allows them to say yes and allows me to make money? Because what you want them to do is to go, yeah, that's reasonable. That's pretty good. Yeah. Okay. Let's try that. And it's easy for them to say yes to. Because what happens is when you go into that business meeting, again, I was taught this by the Americans. I was taught this by a guy called Todd Fleming. It's the only job I've ever had in my life. But I worked for 2.5 years. I was basically CEO of their international division. And Todd Fleming had twice built a company from zero to $40 million in 5 years, twice. And you hang around that person, you go, man, that's how it looks like. He says, basically speaking, when you go into that meeting, there's four things. First of all, do you know what you want? Do you know what you want? Okay. The second thing is, and this is an important thing, and this is the question the Americans ask, which we Brits never ask, is do you have any money? Do you have a budget? Because it costs money. Do you realize this costs money? At the end of the day, I'm going to do something and you're going to pay me money. That's what business is. Do you have a budget? And often they say, well, I'm not sure, I don't know. So let's try and work out what the budget is, because without that, there's nothing there. The third thing is, do you like me? You know, do you feel that we can do some business together? And you can work that out in about the first 3 minutes.
Yep.
And the fourth thing is, are you emotionally ready to sign the bloody contract, to sign the goddamn contract? Because that's what takes 18 months. The first bit takes 7 minutes. The second bit takes 18 months. But that's important. And what you understand is, it's not about selling, because they know if they want it or not. It's about getting them to feel comfortable enough with you to sign the contract. And those
absolutely
are skills. And then finally, and one more thing, just one more thing. I'm going to take you to the next level.
Yeah, the next level for everybody here. Okay.
The next level is, okay, now, so that's doing business. That's getting business in. Now, how do you grow your business? Very simple. Go back to Japan. There's three questions. Well, actually, two questions, really. Is it a mature market or is it a growing market? Is it a market where I've got to still, you know, there's X amount of people there, and I've got to, if you get a client, then I've lost a client. Okay, that's gone. Because it's zero sum game. Or is it an immature market? And if it's an immature market, then it's a growing market. Then over the next 3 to 5 years, you'll grow. So the question is, can I establish myself in a growing market? And can I grow my market share of a growing market? Because if over 3 to 5 years, I can grow my share of a growing market, I should do well. And that, my friend, is why I'm so collaborative. People say to me, why do you do so much business with other people? You know, I support other organizations. I support other people. I do work with other people. And I say, because you have to understand, what I want is another institute, the Security Institute or the Institute of Risk Management or whatever it might be, all of whom I know and I like. I want them to get a nice big contract with Unilever or with Amazon or with Goldman Sachs. I want them to do that. Why? I want to make a big story. Why? I want somebody to get a really nice training contract with an airport in the UK. Why? Because if they do that, then that means another 17 airports are going to have to do training over the next 3 years. Yeah. Now, if I could pick up two of those airports, I don't care what anybody else does, but I've picked up two of those airports. So what those people are doing is they're not taking business away from me, they're developing a market for me, which is why I love it when I see other people doing well, because I know that that creates opportunities for everybody. That's it. That's a business model.
Aren't golden nuggets. That's a golden rush.
It's a gold mine.
Thank you so much for these really important things that you share with us, with all this audience. Just listen out there. Go back a few minutes and listen again what David said. So it's absolutely great. That's for free.
It's for free.
Keep it in mind. That's for free. He shares his content, his experience, lifelong learning stuff with us for free. And if you are in the security, safety, or whatever métier, professional environment, or you're just thinking about them, how I can go out there and just influence or to get an impact at this person, at this organization, or just for my own little small enterprise, company, whatever, as a solopreneur, to start a solopreneur, and after that you have a team maybe, and then you grow and get a good team, maybe an international or globally team. And then did that, like you, David, we have to do that, like everything, it's how do you say that, it's just, it's amazing, it's absolutely amazing. I don't can say anymore.
Yeah, don't forget, it's taken me 40 years. Remember that.
Absolutely.
It doesn't come fast.
Yeah, the time flows. That's absolutely incredible. And we have a lot of nuggets, golden nuggets there that you told us and shared with us. And just let me know that come a little slowly, but straight, but slowly to the end, to the third part of our talk. Is there something that you absolutely, you make a difference between privately and professional environment in thinking risk management, safety, security stuff? Did it separately or just like a unique, it's one thing for you personally? Is this in all of your cells in your body or just you divorce that and say, this is this part and this is this part. I live that differently. How do you handle that?
To a certain extent, I think there's, again, like so many things, there's two parts to that. I mean, it's like somebody's fit. You can't say, are you fit on Sundays and Tuesdays, but not fit on, you know, on Wednesdays and Fridays. This is who I am. It's how I live my life. I have a certain set of beliefs. And it is because of the, you know, the military and the Aikido and the monastery and all that sort of stuff. And it's how I live my life. On the other hand, there's certain things I'm very undisciplined about, you know, which I know which causes me problems. And I think that as you go through certain stages of life, you know, the stage I am in life right now, I think, you know, be kind to yourself, you know, because nobody else is going to be kind to you, but be kind to you, be forgiving of yourself. You know, you don't have to. Life is not a punishment. It's like a good diet. It's like, food. Food is not the enemy. Eat well, eat healthily. But enjoy your food. You know, you don't have to suffer in order to do it, be on a diet. And I think you have to find a balance. And it can take 40 years, but I think you need to find a balance where you feel comfortable in the world and comfortable with yourself. And you know, that there are times when I think I'm doing pretty well. There are times when I don't. You know, I have, you know, those insecurities just like everybody else. And you know, Tony, I mean, as we've discussed this, you know, we have our campfire, global campfires once a week, you know, around coronavirus with many, you know, these have been a tough 2 years. You know, these have been, anybody who's listening to this podcast and is in this industry sector, the likelihood is that the last 2 years have been tough in ways which we've never experienced before. It's been tough for me, really tough as well. And I think it's during those tough times that you know, stuff comes through. I've reached out, I've very publicly reached out and I've said, you know what? I'm having some bad thoughts, you know, I'm really feeling that I'm losing it here. That's not a bad thing. It's only a bad thing if you don't own up to it. These are tough times. These are tough times for our families, for our businesses. We're under stress. It's never ending. I don't know about you, but, you know, I'm doing a bit better now, but there was a time last year. And if you said to me, how are you doing? I said, man, I'm just tired. You know, I'm not even tired. It's beyond tiredness. Luckily I've got through that, but I think for all, and I'm lucky, you know, for those of you who've got young families and you've been at home with young families and financial pressures, that's tough. So I think that this is not a time to put additional stress on ourselves. We have to really, you know, be kind to ourselves. I think from that perspective, as you get older, you get more of a perspective anyway, but I think, you know, have your discipline, believe in your discipline, believe in yourself, and accept that there will be tough days. There will be tough days. I just look at football managers. You know, you look at all the great, great football managers, you know, and every time they lose a match, you know, that it is, you know, you go away and it is putting incredible stress on you. And then you lose three in a row and they're under real pressure, you know, and those people have got a massive, massive support around them. So my thing about sort of do I divide it? To a certain extent, yes, to a certain extent, no. But I think the main thing now is to have that balance, because we're in tough times, and you know, you do not want to put on additional stress.
Absolutely, absolutely. The last 2 years are hard for everybody, I guess. Some big challenges, but that's past, and we will see how we handle that in the future. And future is the right word, the right keyword for us, I guess. What's the next big goal for David, for Dr. David Rubens? What's the big picture of you? I guess I have one thing, maybe just like in the back, or you just lead like that, Leadership Safe and Secure, my book that
Great
I
book.
Wrote it
Great
for
book.
Safety and security stuff, and leadership as well. And I hear something, maybe you can tell us about your project. Maybe it's something in pipeline. Maybe it's that big thing for the next months. Or do you have another big project or a big picture? Tell us about, in a few sentences, if it's possible, what's your next challenges?
I've been working on this book. I mean, I had a book, I actually had two book contracts before COVID, and then COVID came down and stuff happened and I put away. But basically speaking, I'm in the middle right now, actually towards the end of writing a book. And it's a pracademic book. It's this pracademic, practitioner academic. And it is based on my doctorate thesis. I mean, you should always try and turn your doctorate thesis into a book. But basically it says there's a huge amount of good material. Your book is an excellent example. There's good material out there around strategic leadership and risk management, but it tends to be anecdotal. You look at things like Stan McChrystal. I'm sure everybody knows General Stan McChrystal, good friend. We do a lot of work together. I have great admiration for Stan. I love his books, and he's a strong supporter of what we're doing at the ISRM. But those are very anecdotal. They're storytelling books. And one of the things that I've, over the last probably 15 years, certainly talked about is there's a massive amount of really powerful academic work that's been done around all of this stuff, which nobody knows about. The politicians don't know about it, and the policymakers don't know about it, and the advisors don't know about it. So the book is designed to fill that gap and to say, you know, if you want to talk about sense-making or resilience or decision-making or leadership or unprecedented or wicked problems or instability or communications or multi-agency or, you know, for example, EMON. Who knows what an EMON is? Nobody knows what an EMON is. Emergent Multi-Organizational Networks. And it says whatever your plan is, when something goes wrong, you start dealing with the people around you. You start building networks, emergent multi-organizational networks. Well, there's a whole load of academic work that's been done around that, about how you can utilize that and how you can maximize benefit. So it's a technical book. It is an academic technical book, but which we want to be useful to experienced practitioners who say, you know what, I've read Stan McChrystal's book, I've read your book, I've read the other books out there. Is there something a bit more? Is there something slightly more, you know, there? And that's what we wanted to have it there. So we're looking now to, I think we're delivering the final, we're delivering the finished text around, I think, about July. And then there's a process. So we're probably looking at to come out first quarter of next year, 2023. But I'm very excited about that. I think, you know, as you know, in your own life, well, writing a book is an interesting experience. And it's an intense experience as well. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And besides that, I mean, in terms of big projects, the Institute of Strategic Risk Management, we discuss this a lot, the ISRM. I mean, we're now up to 31 chapters. International chapters, and we're doing some fantastic work with some of the largest organizations in the world. They recognize what we do as a global network. And I think developing the academic side to support policymaking at national and regional level, and to say, listen, if you are a national government level decision makers and policymakers, knowing about the academic world really, really helps you. And what I always say is knowing about the academic material doesn't solve your problems, but it gives you a framework to discuss complex issues. And if we look at the world where we're living in, complexity is what it's all about. And most people in organizations, they just are not comfortable. They're not comfortable with complexity. And so what the academic world does, it gives you a structure and a framework to engage with complexity in a structured way. So I would say that that's what I'm really looking forward to, maybe over the next 2-3 probably 3 to 5 years, actually, sort of working down that path.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear. It's an important thing to do. And I guess you did it on the right way the last years and month, and you're on the right path with the organization, the ISRM, and the Institute of... you are all working together, the network that you have around ISSRM and other student associations or professional associations or governmental level or just in a smaller community maybe. Or this would be great to hear, to read, and to see that, and then to spread it out around the world. There are a lot of stuff out there. Change it a little bit more, simplized and not so on a high level, but because you have to understand it, keep it simple, not stupid, but simple and safe to do the right thing in the right time. And I guess we have the right time to come to the end on this podcast and this talk. Wow. But it's absolutely great. We have to do it maybe a second time and by side or the next thing, we can talk about other stuff. But you have so much, you have given us so much content. Golden nuggets, it's like a golden rush for everybody who listen it or see it on YouTube in a few weeks. And David, if you're just thinking about that, you told us 40 years plus, and you have a good life. You lived a good life, and you have a lot traveled around the world, and maybe it's come to an end. Maybe it's your end today. You leave this wonderful planet and go to the other side. What do you guess? What would people say about David Rubens today? What would they say?
Good bloke. Good professional, good bloke. That's all you asked for. Good professional, good bloke. Black Jim, cheers. You know, I'll raise a glass for you, friend. That's, I think, all you can ask for. You can leave. And also the fact that I know that, you know, there's people who feel they have benefited from being in, you know, from stuff we've done together, which is an excellent thing. I hope it doesn't happen, but if it does happen, then I think, you know, a good professional and a good bloke. I think that's I will accept that.
That would be the right thing, a short thing, but cheers.
Yeah, cheers
for you. And I hope you have so many years, but you have to go there and to the end of your life. So I guess 20, 40 years, maybe plus. We don't know.
Last month, my brother-in-law, my wife's husband, who was head of the legal faculty in the University of the South Pacific, very successful lawyer and academic, 63 years old, went to hospital for a checkup, dropped dead, died before he hit the ground, 63 years old. Nothing wrong with him, fit, healthy, 63 years old, died. So you know what? We never know. You just absolutely, and you get to a certain age, these things happen. So if there's one thing I'd say to everybody is go home, hug your family, hug and love your family, my friends, because you just never know. You just never know.
That should be the right thing to do that and to keep that in mind, that nobody knows when the clock bells. Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. I guess we are at the end of this interview, of this talk. And it was a pleasure, a big, great pleasure to talk with you, to get your insights. And everybody who just think about that, go back and listen it again, what David said and what the content, you can take it out and use that. Use that for your professional, privately life. And we will just keep you in mind as well. And we follow you and we'll see how much grows your association, the Institute of Strategic Risk and Management and Crisis Management topics, safety, security topics, whatever we need in our future world, in a government level, in an enterprise level, for all the companies, the big organizations, the smaller ones, whatever. And David, but if somebody out there listen to your podcast and your insights and just, how I can get in contact, how I get contact with David. I have to speech with him. I have to write him an email, whatever. Where's the channel?
Well, first of all, you can go to the ISR. Just look up Institute of Strategic Risk Management, www.isrm.org. Or I'm on LinkedIn. And you know what? As you know, Anton, I love talking about this stuff. I love hearing about it from other people. Genuinely, if people would like to be in touch, I'd be very happy to do so. And if you want to become a member of the Institute, you know, get in touch. We'd be delighted to have you. We really would.
Absolutely. We will just put that in the show notes down below. And everybody can get the right path to you, to take contact, to get in contact with you and the organization. And now at the end, just let's finish the sentence. I'll let you finish this small sentence, and I don't recommend that and get any comments about that. I just let it there, and then we are finished our time. Thank you, David, for your time, for your big insights, golden nuggets, all the stuff. It's absolutely incredible. I have to listen that again and again, I guess, twice, because there are so things inside. For everybody, you can use that and in a private, professional way, or maybe as a student, the further education for a bachelor, master degree, whatever, we talk about that. And the last sentence that would ask you to let it finish you, it's just, David, the life, your life, is too short for what?
So, okay, there you've lost me. How do you mean that, Tony? Sorry, my life is too short for?
Too short for what? Your life or our life is too short to. Can you finish this sentence?
It's too short to waste time, but you know, you have to be nice to yourself as well. I would say have a, as you said, a North Star. This is my life has been this. You can decide who you want to be. You can create the person you want to be. And you can do that. You can start that today. And it's a lifetime's process, but you can create the person you want to be. So enjoy it. Life is a wonderful thing. It's a rare thing. Enjoy it. Be good. Be nice, be good, do good things.
Be kind.
Be kind.
Oh, I said something. Sorry about that.
David. You still have the last word, Tony. You still have the last word. There you go.
Thank you very, very much. It was a great time.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for having you in this podcast episode. We will see what's going on. Take care for you and your family and your lovely ones.
Thank you.
And I hope you have a good time in the next few weeks, and I hope we will see us maybe in a few weeks or in springtime somewhere, or online or physical. What's going on? We don't know exactly. Corona and COVID and traveling and restriction, but I guess we have the chance to get in contact and to keep contact online for everybody. And who knows? Maybe someone's listen this podcast, this episode, and you get a lot of emails, a lot of content, comments, or a lot of likes, something like that. Have a good time, David. See you, and thank you. I appreciate that.
All the best.
Very well. Bye.
Bye. All the best. Bye.